So this talk is going to be, for the most part, a review of these three notions that I have in the title. And hopefully, from the way I review what they are, it should be clear that, those are closely related to each other. And then I will specify more precisely how we think they are related. And maybe in the end, I will show some more detailed argument of why this relation holds. But probably I will not have much time to do this. But I still think that it's good to review, because it doesn't make sense proving that three things are the same unless it is clear what the three things are. OK, so this, the asymptotic fragility, this is something we invented with Sergey and Merdad about 4 or 5 years ago. And this is a prescription to modify 1+1 dimensional quantum field theories at the level of an S matrix in a way that they become gravitational two-dimensional field theories. OK, this TT bar deformation, it is a thing developed by Roberto Tateo and collaborators, and also in a last year's paper by Zamolodchikov and Smirnov. And this is also a way to deform two-dimensional quantum field theories by an irrelevant deformation. It's called TT bar, and I will explain what this deformation is and what are the properties of these deformed theories. And then near ADS2 holography, so probably you have heard much, a lot about it recently. There was some spike in activity in ADS2 holography, particularly triggered by SYK model. And okay, and then I will review these two things as well, and we'll see how they're related to each other. Okay, so asymptotic fragility, that comes first. And first, let's remember how we think about quantum field theories in general. Okay, so quantum field theory, for me, it is some RG flow that originates at the UV CFT and flows to some IR CFT. And in principle, this IR CFT can be anything, can be interacting IR fixed point. But for most, it's better, for what I'm going to talk about today, it's better to think about it as a free theory or just an empty or some gapped phase. So that when this CFT is empty. But most of the things can be generalized to interacting IR fixed point, but that introduces some extra subtleties. So if we have a picture like this, then I say that this quantum field theory can be defined by an S matrix, okay? And again, you may be worried that there are some non-local objects in quantum field theories that S matrix maybe doesn't capture, but that's not what I'm going to be concerned about. For me, quantum field theory is defined by an S matrix, and so for this first part of the talk, I think about this flow as just infinite 1+1 dimensional Minkowski space. Okay, so this is a Lorentzian picture that we're going to have now. So the S matrix, it has a few properties, which is first of them is very important. It's unitarity. That SS dagger is equal to 1. And the second one, which is, well, analyticity. Which more, maybe more precise version of analyticity is crossing symmetry, which says that the S matrix, well, it can be written, okay, let me, when I put N, it means I consider some S matrix element for scattering of N particles. It can be written as some delta function of sum of momentum times an amplitude, which is analytic function of Mandelstam variables. So this is just pi plus pj squared. And analyticity tells us that this function A, it can have only certain restricted type of singularities. And crossing symmetry, it basically tells us what is the domain of analyticity and what happens, how various elements of an S matrix are connected to each other when we analytically continue across this domain. Okay? What is kind of special to two dimensions is that there are other pieces that contain more delta functions. Okay? And in particular, there is a piece which contains product of n over 2 delta functions of all them, well, let me not write all of them. When all the momenta of particles are conserved individually. Okay, so this is, there are, in particular, the integrable theories which only have this piece. And this happens because collinear singularities in two dimensions are very strong. So basically some poles that just usual three-level poles that we see in all S matrices in any number of dimensions, they add up and produce extra delta functions. Okay? So in this talk, so it's important that all my talk just conceptually about completely generic two-dimensional quantum field theory. So I'm not going to use integrability much, but there will be kind of couple of examples which make simplify, of course, when the theory is included. But this is not going to be an assumption. Okay, I'm going to talk about general quantum field theories. Okay, so and there is a third property of S matrices that actually uses. So these two things are extremely general, right? There is a third property that uses the fact that my RG flow terminates at the UV fixed point. And this says that when I take all my Sijs to infinity, that if I go to the UV limit, then the S matrix goes to, well, it goes to a constant, to some, basically to identity. There can be some rotation in Flavier space, but basically it goes to something very trivial in the UV. And this happens because, so if I go to high energy limit, then my particles effectively become massless, so I just have left movers and right movers. And in a CFT, in a two-dimensional CFT, holomorphic and anti-holomorphic parts, they do not talk to each other. Okay, so scattering becomes trivial if this is a CFT. Good. So this property, they seem very general, but it is very hard to write functions that satisfy those two properties. Okay, we do not know any explicit example, any closed form for a function satisfying these two properties. Apart from the cases, these integrable cases, where the analytic structure of S matrix, it simplifies a lot. But then these properties, in addition with some an extra requirement that arises if you have this factorization, which is Young-Baxter equation, this is usually enough to more or less fix the S matrix. Okay, so this one, this bootstrap S matrix bootstrap problem is kind of successful in the simplified form. So these properties are not so easy to satisfy. Okay, so now. Now, let me explain to you what is asymptotic fragility. So this is the following statement. This is the statement that for any S matrix, I can write what I call the dressed, so this, there's a procedure which we call gravitational dressing. to any for any quantum field theoretic S matrix that is that satisfies those properties, I can define a new one, which is going to be the gravitationally dressed S matrix, okay? That satisfies it satisfies one and two, so it stays unitary. It stays crossing symmetric, and all analyticity properties hold. But this property of going to a constant in the ultraviolet, it gets violated in an interesting way. Okay? And our philosophy is that this actually couples a quantum field theory to gravity at the level of S matrix directly. So why do we say so? Well, this is because for gravity, we do not expect a picture like this. So when I say quantum field theory, I implicitly assume that it is not a gravitational theory. And it means, in particular, it means this, that there is a CFT in the V. Well, for gravity, we do not expect to find a simple conformal field theory in the ultraviolet. So there are different statements why this should be true. For example, there is Weinberg-Witten theorem that tells us that there is no like T mu nu that is conserved and defined microscopically. But one kind of part of this, one lesson, I guess, of this study of ours is that in this two-dimensional case, this intuition holds, indeed, that we invented this this prescription that changes the UV behavior of an S matrix, and indeed it turned out, back then we did not understand what type of two-dimensional gravity it is, but now we understand, and this is what I'm going to explain. Okay, so what is this prescription? This is actually something relatively simple, okay? So in two dimensions, is special because the boundary, so this is now my Minkowski two-dimensional space, okay, and I draw some asymptotic boundary. It's not important what's the shape of this boundary, and I see how my particles cross this boundary. So this is some ingoing particles, okay, and there are some outgoing. So time goes in this direction, okay. There are some outgoing particles. And this, I drew their momenta, and I draw outgoing momenta like this, well, because that's how we usually do, that's consistent with how I write the energy momentum conservation, okay? So they have negative energies, outgoing particles. And once I drew them like this on a circle, I can actually order them, okay? So I can do this in ordering. I can label my particles, 1, 2, 3, blah, 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 n, okay? So this is special to two dimensions. There is no obvious ordering in high dimensions. But in two dimensions, it exists. And once I have this ordering, I can define my S hat in the following way. It's going to be some parameter LS squared. And there is a sum of PI star PJ. I smaller than J. This is going to be S. So this is for each n-leg S matrix element that's happened separately. And this star, this is simply an anti-symmetrized product, okay? It's epsilon alpha beta, pi alpha, p j beta. So it is a relatively simple expression. So you see it's a pure phase. It's multiplying an S matrix by a phase. But it is actually, it's not so obvious that it does not break this analyticity and unitarity properties, okay? So the unitarity is relatively easy to show. Well, both are not so complicated, but it's not immediately obvious. So if I call this factor, if I call this thing D, then actually, because of energy momentum conservation, because of this anti-symmetrized property of this exponent, D can be written as a product of where a sum is taking only pairs, only for pairwise interaction of in particles times the same for out particles, okay? So this is just true about this expression. And then in this way, unitarity becomes manifest. Because if I put it into SS dagger, it's just a face. So I have this D acting on out states, D in acting on in states, and then they square to one. Okay? And well, crossing symmetry also, in principle, so this thing is something like square root of Sij times I don't remember what it contains extra contains some extra singularities in terms of Sij, so you may get worried that you introduce some non-physical singularities, but actually structure of the singularities is exactly such that when you analytically continue through the physical sheet, the particles you see, the tricky part of crossing symmetry in 1 plus 1 dimension is that when I say swap two particles, well, and then being on shell, they necessarily go through each other. So there is a point where they coincide, so I kind of go through new singularity. But it turns out that singularity structure of this is exactly the right one to ensure that this anti-symmetry, this ordering holds under analytic continuation. Okay, I'm not going to show this, but this is something we checked. Okay, very good. So why is this interesting at all? The interesting part is that it happens. So yes, first thing is just interesting that this thing exists. So I'm pretty sure that this is more or less a unique way, unique like universal thing that you can multiply S matrices by so that you keep those two properties. I will be very surprised if you can come up with another one. For example, if you take a product of two S matrices, you get something that violates either one or two. Okay, just to make sure. Another thing why it's interesting is that when we go to the UV limit. So if we go to let me consider just the 2-2-2 S matrix element for simplicity. Okay. And so this 2-2-2 S matrix element, it only depends on one Mandelstam variable S. So when S goes to infinity, then the initial S matrix goes to a constant over there. Let's say it goes to identity. Yeah, that was our assumption because there was a CFT in the UV. However, the Drest S matrix goes into the following thing. So LS squared, this is just a parameter of my deformation. This is a parameter of dimensional length squared. So, sorry. It goes to e to the is, okay? So it never, no matter to how large energies I go, it doesn't become trivial. It becomes just some oscillating phase factor. And this is a, kind of a very well-known expression. This is actually in any number of dimensions, if I consider the shockwave scattering of in gravitational theory, in any number of dimensions, if I consider shockwave scattering at high energies, I get this universal shockwave phase, okay, which includes like Shapiro time delay in it. This is what led us to thinking that, okay, this means that there is actually gravitational, that we added gravitational scattering to the S matrix. Okay? So now, another interesting point is that we can try to say more quantitatively what do we mean by not having a CFT in the ultraviolet in this theory. Because, okay, this argument with holomorphic, anti-holomorphic things, decoupling, maybe it's a little bit too hand-wavy. We can do something more precise. And in particular, well, it looks like in the UV, it's not really that important what the initial S metric was. So we can just start with a system of N free bosons, okay? So the S matrix is just identity matrix, and then dress them by this procedure so that we give them this. So this scattering stays integrable, of course. So if I dress a free theory, if I dress any integrable theory, it stays integrable in the sense that I do not, if I only had this piece, I do not produce any of these pieces, of course, okay? So it stays integrable. And if it is integrable, then I can actually study in more details what happens to my RG flow. In particular, I can compactify the theory on a circle. So I take this, then I dress, okay? Then I compactify on a circle. And I ask, what is the spectrum of my theory on a circle of radius r, okay? And then if theories are integrable, you can do something called thermodynamic Bethe-Ansatz that I'm not going to review, but it's basically a machine which if you have an integrable S matrix, it spits out for you the energy spectrum on a circle, okay? And it turns out that in this case, it's, so I do this and I calculate energy spectrum. It's TDA. And what I get the following. Okay, well, yeah, let me write the full expression. So I get the following formula, which is and here I get minus plus plus tilde minus and there is some 4 pi. So maybe I some factors of 2 might be wrong. But well, first of all, this is probably a very familiar formula. This is simply a spectrum of a critical bosonic string in n plus 2 spacetime dimensions, where n and little n and tilde, this is just number of left and right movers. Okay, but for us, the important lesson here is that if I look in particular at the ground state energy, then the ground state energy, okay, I'm just setting n and l tilde to zero here. It becomes, for r small enough, it becomes complex, okay? And this is in contrast to any other normal quantum field theory, integrable, definitely, quantum field theory. If I ran this TBA procedure, I would have gotten some function that is well-defined up to arbitrary small r, and actually by looking at asymptotics of this expression, of the ground state energy, at small r, that's how one can extract like a central charge of the UV CFT. So the general behavior should have been, so this is not equal, but it should have been something like CUV over r, okay? So this is the way that we understand that something funny is going on in this theory when we're trying to go to the UV, when trying to put it in short distance. Okay, good. So this concludes the this first part of the summary. So if there, unless there are some questions, I'll go to TT-bar deformation.
Asymptotic fragility.
Sorry.
Why is it called
asymptotic? Well, so asymptotic fragility, it comes from like playing with whether it's asymptotic freedom, asymptotic safety, and this is something more weird. So the reason we call it fragility is that, well, so in spite of this weirdness of, say, finite volume spectrum, et cetera, we believe that this theory is like well-defined, because the S matrix is well defined, it satisfies all the properties. So we believe that this theory makes sense, and I will show some support of this evidence in the remaining of the talk. But we believe that it's something very special, that if you try to deform it a little bit, okay, then probably the theory will just stop making sense. So this is why we call it fragility. The RG flows, we know very well how to deform them, like say perturb it by some extra relevant operators in the UV, and you get still theories that make sense, okay? So this RG flow, of course I can perturb my initial quantum field theory before I dress it and then dress it. But once I'm working with this dress theory, we don't really know how to deform them. So they look like this. This UV behavior is something very special. But yeah, this is where the name is coming from. But yeah, good. Okay, more questions?
So do you have some way of taking a limit where you can ignore the gravity, so to speak, in that formula for E0, or is it like they're just not connected?
You mean UV limit?
Yeah, so, no, I mean, so this is a gravitational dress theory, you said the energy spectrum.
This I just took n free bosons and then gravitationally dressed them and calculated the spectrum. So the point here is that, so what's known is that you take arbitrary CFT and deform the gravitationally dressed, you get something very similar. So if you take arbitrary integrable quantum field theory and gravitationally dress it, you get something very similar. So if you take a generic field theory and dress it, we expect that there is some kind of singularity like this, but I cannot prove it.
I was asking if there's a way to go from that to that. Well, like
from here?
Yeah, from the thing that you said it wasn't equal to, so below.
Oh, from here?
Like, is there some limiting procedure in which you can...
Oh, is it still uncoded? Well, not really. I mean, if I set LS to zero, then yes, but this is stupid because...
Okay, but that's the limit.
Yeah, yeah, LS to zero, this thing disappears.
Right, that's what I wanted.
Yes, yes. So bad things happen at R of order one of order LS. So if LS, oh, I know, good things happen, interesting things happen at R of order LS. So if you take LS to zero, then you can take R to zero without. Okay, good. Okay, let me tell you this the TT bar deformation thing. Okay, so first let's remember what is so. T and T bar, they simply stay for holomorphic and anti-holomorphic components of stress tensor, which if we rewrite them through the usual one, it is something like, I think it's some 1/4 Txx minus Tyy plus I think 2 Txy. There are some pi's in the normalization. T bar is the there is an I. There is an I here, so T bar is this thing conjugated, and there is also an object that I'm going to need, which is theta, which is the trace of energy momentum tensor. Tyy. Okay, so this is 1/4, I think. These are just the definitions, and this to define this object TT bar, we first define a kind of bilocal operator. Okay, T of z, T bar of z prime minus theta of z prime. This is something, by the way, that Zamolodchikov did in around 2004, just without any application, just trying to understand what is this operator. Again, in an arbitrary quantum field theory, it's important here that I'm not doing CFT, I'm not doing integral, I'm doing arbitrary 1+1 dimensional quantum field theory. Although for this part of the talk. You see, I already started using Euclidean rotation, so I'm going to be Euclidean, and I'm going to be on either on a torus, which is very squeezed torus, or in a cylinder. Okay, so for this, so here I was thinking about my theory in flat Minkowski space. So now let me start thinking about some again arbitrary 1+1 dimensional quantum field theory, but on the Euclidean torus or an Euclidean cylinder, okay? So then I first define this operator that depends on two, that is located at 2 points, z and z bar. And then Zamolodchikov, he in that paper, he shows two things. He shows that actually limit, so how do I call it? Let me call it C of ZZ bar, okay? So he shows that the limit of Z going to C prime of this C of ZZ prime, so that this limit exists, okay? And this he shows by doing some OPE expansions of this operator, and I'm not going to go through this now. But as a part of this proof, he shows that this object C, Z, and Z prime, it's actually independent. So this DZ of C, Z prime, that any state, sorry, correlation, expectation value of this operator in any state, in any eigenstate of energy and momentum operator, okay? So N is an eigenstate of Hamiltonian, and it is an eigenstate of momentum operator. So in any state, which is an eigenstate, this object C is independent of the coordinates, okay? And this is kind of already shows you that probably the limit Z to Z prime should exist. So what are the assumptions? The assumptions are very general. It's just Lorentz invariance, okay? So it is relativistic, which I used, of course, by just, well, I didn't say that it's symmetric, but if I have a symmetric locally conserved T mu nu, then this is true, okay? And well, this can be done very easily. It's just from the momentum, from energy momentum conservation, which in this language it just reads that, say, TZZ is like dz bar theta. So if you, and there is a conjugate equation. So if you act with this equation on this expression, then you can show that it's actually independent of the coordinate. Okay, we can go through this this relatively fast. So then Zamolodchikov does the following trick. He says, if this is independent of z and z bar, let me go to the limit from z and z prime. Let me separate z and z prime very far away. Okay. Then again, if I separate very far away, then the expectation value should factorize. Okay. So this is by definition the TT bar operator. Okay. The name TT bar comes because he first started thinking about it in CFTs, but in fact, in general theory, you need to subtract the trace squared. Okay. So what we want to understand, what is this diagonal expectation value of TT bar operator in terms of some more simple objects that we understand. And he said that go to Z very far away from each other, okay? I'm being confusing. This is already a local operator, so this is taken at some point, right? But I'm skipping steps of the proof. Substitute this, take the limit Z and Z prime to infinity. And then it should factorize, okay? And then this becomes the product of expectation values of T and T bar minus the square of the expectation value of the trace. Okay? Very good. So the next step is to rewrite this thing through more conventional components of the energy momentum tensor. This is just simple algebra. I mean, you just plug this in, okay? And what you get the following. You get ty1 y minus, t xy squared. Okay? Very good. So now these are actually the objects that we know what they are. Well, so let's think of y as like Euclidean time. Okay? Then tyy is just okay, let me not write n. It's everywhere. It's not a vacuum. It's in the state n, okay? So this is obviously the energy of the nth state over R, okay? And the txy, for the same reason, this is the momentum, okay? What is a little bit less trivial is that we also know what is txx. This is actually derivative of energy with respect to the radius. Okay? Again, everything in state. And so this is very good. We expressed all the expectation values of our TT bar operator in terms of energy and momentum of our state. Okay? So now we're coming to this TT bar deformed quantum field theories. In particular, we consider some QFT, which is, say, described by some action, okay? And we add to it the TT bar operator to the action with some, say, infinitesimally small parameter, LS squared, okay? As you know, by looking, say, on a partition function on a large torus, to leading order in perturbation theory, all energy states shift by the expectation value of the operator with which we deformed our theory. Okay? So we can write a differential equation. And okay, the philosophy, so it's clear what happens to the leading order in LS. But the way the TT bar deformation is defined, so I start with some QFT, which could have been this RG flow, but I should just shrunk it to a point. So I start with QFT, and then I deform it with the TT bar operator. And the claim is that to integrate this, so this is obviously, this is an irrelevant operator, okay? What makes it unusual? It's an operator of, if QFT is a CFT, then this is an operator of dimension 4, so it's an irrelevant operator. So I'm flowing into the UV. And these flows are usually well defined. I mean, we don't really know how to talk about these flows in general case. But here we know, because we just postulate that at each point, the tangential to this flow in the space of quantum field theories is the TT bar operator kind of already calculated at this point. Okay? Good. Is that clear? And by doing this, by staring at this expression, we can write a differential equation for the energy spectrum of our theory that is true for finite LS, okay? And so what is this? So we know, I want DE, so I have some family of theories parameterized by parameter LS squared, and they sit also on some, on a cylinder of radius R, and I know how the energy spectrum depends. So this is the expectation value of TT bar operator, what multiplied by R, because I integrate, right? At the theory of some finite LS, which is just this expression, right? It's dE by dR times E. Sorry, I will not get the sign wrong, especially because I've forgotten. You shouldn't look at the video, take all the formulas, and treat them seriously with signs and factors of two, okay? But some important things I'm trying to capture. Minus p squared over r, okay? And this is
So this is a differential, it's a closed form differential equation for the energy spectrum. Okay, good. So now, this equation, this is especially for p squared equal to zero, it's a known equation, it's a Burgers equation, that actually has, there is a closed form expression on for solutions of this equation, which implicitly can be found like something like this. There is like R plus LS squared P LS squared R. I think it's something like this. There are a few things. This is not even important that this exists. First of all, these equations are known to have singularities at small r. So in this case, you're pretty sure that if you're trying to go to small r, you'll hit a singularity. Okay. Moreover, if we start with E with undeformed energy spectrum, which is just a spectrum of, say, a free particle, okay? So this is some this plus whatever the plus the Casimir plus the Casimir energy is probably negative, okay? So this is the free n free bosons, okay? And if I put it in this equation, so I take n free bosons as the boundary conditions for my Burgers equation at LS equals zero, and then I solve this equation. Okay, you can guess that you get exactly this. Okay, so this proves that at least for free theories, this TT bar deformation defined this way is exactly the same thing as I defined in the law of S method. Okay, this was proven for integrable theories. But for non-integrable theories, like maybe till later, what's proven, what's not. But the main point here is that this is the thing that can also be defined for arbitrary local quantum field theory. Okay, so for me, okay, different philosophy, but for me, like gravity is some kind of unique thing that can be universally coupled to any Lorentz invariant theory. And here we're dealing with this also two objects that exist for any Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. This dressing of an S matrix and this deformation by T, because every theory has T, and for every theory, TT bar has these nice properties. And so it exists for any deformation. So that's what makes us believe mostly that these two things are the same. Okay, good. Any questions about?
So what happens if you have TT bar with the wrong sign? Like, do you have to choose up?
Yes. Well, same question you could have asked, what happens if I do the wrong sign here? Okay, so signs agree, not necessarily on the blackboard, but in reality, there is a relation, of course, between the signs. And what, okay, good. What determines the physical sign here, to me, is that for one sign, for the wrong sign, this S matrix becomes superluminal. So instead of Shapiro time delay, which becomes very large at large energies, you get Shapiro time advance, okay? Which is something that looks bad. Mm-hmm. And from the property of analyticity of an S matrix, you get the essential singularity in the upper half plane at infinity, which is kind of violates at least some axioms of S matrix thing. What happens to the spectrum? So spectrum actually belongs to this blackboard in principle, right? It's more like a finite volume properties. What happens to the spectrum is that if I switch the sign, for example, here, I'm switching the sign of LS squared. So there is no singularity for ground state energy. So you may be happy, oh, it's actually better because I can go to short distances. But what happens instead is that even for large radii, highly excited states, they get complex energies. Okay, so you see, if I switch the sign, well, it may not be obvious from this expression, but just trust me that if you switch the sign of this, then the ground state energy part becomes well-defined for short distances. But now excited states. So your Hamiltonian stops being Hermitian just for some excited states. So this is what happens. So now I do not know if this is good or bad or... It sounds more strange. I mean, one sign is clearly more conventional. Okay, let's put it this way. One sign leads to more conventional. Another question?
12 minutes.
Yeah. Well, so you have 12 minutes to review ADS2 holography. Let me put it. Okay, let me actually put it here. No, because this is... Okay, so now let's finally go to the description where we put gravity at the level of the Lagrangian, which is something more conventional, and then we will immediately remember that there is a problem with two-dimensional gravity, that if I just mimic higher dimensions, if I write the square root of minus gr and maybe there's some cosmological constant term, and if I write the matter in this metric g mu nu and some matter field chi, then this theory doesn't make much sense. The reason is that this is a total derivative in two dimensions. So if I try to derive Einstein equations, this thing does not contribute. And what I get that t mu nu of matter, t mu nu of matter of this chi field is equal to zero. That's not something we want, right? We want theory which can support non-trivial matter excitations. Okay? So to cure this, the suggestion is consider, I think a modern understanding, that gravitational theory that makes sense in two dimensions, this is the dilaton gravity, or what's called Jakeev-Teitelbaum gravity. So that's defined instead by multiplying the Einstein-Hilbert action itself is total derivative, we cannot write it, we multiply it by the dilaton field phi, okay? And then there are a few new terms in the Lagrangian that appear. In particular, okay, let me write them here. Here. There is a potential term for the dilaton that I'm going to take the simplest one. Just a constant 2 over L squared. Okay, good, yes. This is it for now, but the important point is which metric do you couple to matter, okay? And so this is a question of some field redefinitions. In particular, like you see, I did not write any kinetic term for the dilaton, but this is because by redefining my metric, I can actually produce or remove this kinetic term, speed him out of the Einstein-Hilbert term. But in the basis where I do not write any kinetic term for the dilaton, I do not couple dilaton to matter, okay? So this is an important. This is different, for example, from some. There is like CGHS gravity, that theory is much more complicated because actually they couple some phi times g mu nu to matter. Okay, so this is important. But I will not get to those details in 10 minutes. But just to be concise. Okay, so now this theory now allows us to consider, in particular, anti-de Sitter backgrounds. Because you can see that the equation of motion for the dilaton now sets R curvature to be a constant. Okay? So if I choose this constant of proper sign, then this is actually anti-de Sitter space. And you see that because curvature is constant, there are no dynamical gravitons, of course, in the bulk. But the claim is that there are some global boundary degrees of freedom that still survive. Okay, and so for this, especially, well, because we're interested in ADS CFT, so we want to define our theory on some surface on ADS background with the boundary, and then take this boundary to the boundary of ADS space. Okay, so for this, it's important to remember about boundary terms, and in particular, I have some boundary. So this is Euclidean ADS. We can say this is Euclidean ADS. Okay, so I draw this Euclidean ADS, say as a disk. Okay, and I consider my theory on some cutout part of this disk. Okay, so this is my boundary, and it's called B, and then I have some boundary terms. One of them is the extrinsic curvature, and there is also the length of the boundary. Okay, so now I defined my theory on a part of ADS space with the boundary, and it has, and I can run the my ADS CFT logic. Okay, so. What is the important point? Why is it called near ADS2 holography? Okay, it's called near ADS2 holography because even though the space is exactly ADS, the dilaton actually gets some wav that breaks ADS isometries. Okay, so in particular, if I work in I'm skipping lots of space, but let me define my ADS space in terms of embedding coordinates, okay? So these are x, that satisfy with some metric L squared, so I have three embedding space coordinates, and these coordinates, the dilaton solution is something very simple. It depends on constant. It depends on arbitrary vector in the embedding space, but you see that this background breaks all but one ADS isometry. Okay, that's why this thing is called near ADS isometry. So now the important point is the following: the dilaton doesn't couple directly to matter. So you may say, "Oh, I do not care. Dilaton does something; it breaks ADS isometry, but I should still have a valid CFT." But this is not the case because of, basically because of the boundary equations. The boundary equations, if you look at Einstein equations of the boundary, they tell me that the boundary is located where the dilaton is equal to this constant phi b. So dynamics of this system, you can think of dynamics of this thing as the following, is that I have some matter sources, okay, that I say I shoot some particles from the boundary. And then the dilaton gets deformed. He back reacts to those sources. And that's why the boundary itself gets deformed, because boundary has to see it as the constant value of the dilaton. Okay. So this boundary dynamics is all that is there from the gravitational part of the theory. Okay, because there are no local degrees of freedom. So now we can see what happens what happens to the ADS CFT prescription. Okay, so suppose I have some CFT that lives off this bound. So okay, let me be precise. First let's put, okay, there is some G Newtons here. Let's take this G Newton to infinity. So let's decouple gravity, but still have just fixed rigid ADS2 space. Okay? Then I can put some quantum field theory in this rigid ADS2 space, and it will generate some conformal, it will generate some non-local CFT1 on the boundary. Okay, so this is kind of this logic that Pedro and the collaborators that they've been following recently. So probably you're aware of this strategy. Okay, so say this procedure. So first I decouple gravity. And I produce some boundary correlators. Okay. So now the question is, what happens to those correlators when I turn on gravity, right? And well, we can do this by the following trick. We can go to the gauge where the metric is just my background ADS metric. So curvature is always a constant, but I can also, it means that I can, in two dimensions, I can pick a gauge where just my metric is not disturbed, okay? And in this gauge, the boundary will be disturbed. So I can calculate what is the action for my boundary perturbations, okay? So say my boundary, the B, is given by some x a of theta. Okay, I can do it in embedded coordinates. Can do it in some fixed coordinate system. The statement is that this action, the action for the boundary will be coming from this boundary term because on shell this is zero. Okay. The action will be coming from this boundary term. And this is something which is called the Schwarzian action. So this, there's one thing I'm skipping. So boundary is actually, so I need to impose some gauge condition on just fixed boundary parameterization. So I fix this boundary parameterization to be a constant, then boundary is actually parameterized by only one variable. Let's call it theta of u. So u is the, so theta is the bulk coordinate, and u is the one-dimensional coordinate that parameterizes the boundary. So boundary is just described by one coordinate because the other one I express through this condition. And then the statement that the boundary action, it becomes this the Schwarzian action, okay, which is given by the something like this. Maybe I ignored some total derivatives. So this is something that you probably heard about. It has some nice features with respect to how it realizes this broken ADS2 isometries. The prescription here, the answer to what happens to correlators when I restore my gravity, when I couple to it, is that these initial correlators, they get dressed. Okay, so let me basically write this last formula. So these correlators, they get transformed into the, sorry, these are O's. After I take a path integral over, my boundaries, yeah, I'm basically done. After I take path integral over my boundaries, these boundary correlators, they get dressed because this, you see that they depend, U is, I take a, okay, let me just write it. So I take a path integral over thetas with the Schwarzian action, where the initial correlators, they act as sources according to the following prescription, this oath that depend on eta i's of u. So there is this pre-factor that comes from the fact when I do, you know, how the operators transform under the change of variables. So I'm doing change of variable from u to theta of u. My correlators start to depend on theta of u. They spit out this conformal prefactor. And this acts as a source for my functional integral for theta. Okay. So the last thing here is that the coefficient in front of this action, it is actually proportional to L squared. So when I do it for ADS of finite radius, this is some nonlinear action, okay? And my sources are some very complicated operators as far as theta is concerned. So this is something very complicated. But in the limit when L goes to infinity, this is a large coefficient in front of the action, so the theory, theta almost decouples. So I can only keep the quadratic part of this action. Okay, and I can only keep linear part of the source term. It's not completely obvious, but that's something we can show. And that's why there is a suspicion that this flat space limit of the Schwarz and Dreising of the correlators is something relatively simple. Okay, and the claim is this, so that's what we showed, that if you take this relatively complicated action, but then only look at the terms which survive in L to infinity limit, you actually get exactly this formula for the S matrix, for modification of the S matrix elements that arise at the flat space limit of this conformal correlate. Okay? Okay, so now, so let me conclude that, so there are these three objects. Okay, so there is this just prescription that is defined at the level of an S matrix. There is a prescription that defined as a modification of finite volume spectrum of any quantum field theory, which is related to some particular special operator that is present in any quantum field theories. And then there is this I think it's current understanding that there is some universal piece that is present in all holographic one-dimensional conformal field theories. Yeah, I didn't say that this piece actually breaks conformal invariance, and that's related to the fact that one-dimensional conformal field theories do not really exist, but there is something that's close to one-dimensional conformal field theories, and I think when they are holographic, there is some universal piece that corresponds to the Schwarzian action that is present to all of them, and then the bulk dual of this Schwarzian piece is some dynamics of dilaton is Jakiev Tetelboehm gravity, and the statement is that if CFT is holographic, then you should be able to take a flat space limit, and what this Schwarzian, this contribution of the Schwarzian in the flat space limit results into exactly the same effect. Okay, so I guess this, I'll stop here. Good question. Yeah. So gravity is not dynamical, but two-dimensional CFTs exist without any problem, right? So now, is there? There is also universal piece. In these papers about like SLK model and about the Schwarzian piece, the Schwarzian piece is sometimes compared to like universal contribution of energy momentum tensor. I'm talking about the boundary now. So yes, in this sense, there is some vague analogy that there is a universal piece in any CFT, in any two-dimensional CFT, the universal piece, which is contribution to energy momentum tensor. Now, if you are in a holographic two-dimensional CFT, then this piece becomes dominant in a sense, and this also corresponds to universal bulk contribution of graviton exchange, which is, again, gravitons are not dynamical, but there is this boundary gravitons, and there is some part of scattering, which is obviously related to exchange of those gravitons. Okay? So this analogy holds here in the sense that there is a universal piece, which is Schwarzian. It also dominates. Here it kind of always dominates, or whatever, we understand less, but looks like it dominates. And also, I claim this is the universal gravitational dynamics. Okay? So now, here I can calculate it explicitly. In three-dimensional gravity, well, there are some works, you know, but I cannot give you a closed form expression for like an S matrix in three dimensions, right? So it's more complicated. But in this sense, some analogy holds. I do not quite understand why. Here it seems like this boundary gravitons kind of play a bigger role. Maybe it's because 1 plus 1 is even, you know, more IR divergent than 2 plus 1, so boundary is even more important. But yes.
Other questions? If not, just stand speaker then.